One of the great men of church history was St. Augustine. St. Augustine's work was in the days just before and during the fall of the Roman Empire. St. Augustine, like other great men, had a very powerful influence, both for good and bad, on subsequent centuries. The influence of St. Augustine has been determinative both in Catholicism and in Protestantism, so that both of these two great branches of Christendom can rightfully look to St. Augustine as the great church father and the profound influence on their formation. We are interested this morning in St. Augustine's eschatology. Eschatology means the doctrine of the last things. In eschatology, we deal with how the future of the world is to be determined as it approaches the end of all things. Now, those who are premillennial have a particular type of eschatology. Those who are amillennial, another. Those who are postmillennial have still a different form of eschatology. Those are the three main branches of eschatological thinking. The eschatology of St. Augustine was very profoundly influenced by his background, which tended to be Manichaean. Now, Manichaeanism was a very powerful religion of the day, which spread throughout the Roman Empire, was very popular in army circles, and carried by the army wherever it went. For a time, Manichaeanism was a great rival of Christianity. It also had a very profound influence on Christianity, a very deep one, and it was a thoroughly bad influence. The basic belief of Manichaeanism was that there are essentially two kinds of gods and two kinds of being. On the one hand, there is the good God, who is spirit, mind, life. Then there is the bad God, who is matter, who is desire, and who is darkness. Now this meant the world was divided in half, and Manichaeanism could not agree with Christianity that the world had been made by God. Genesis declares that in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth. Things both spiritual and things material, all the work of God. And God, when he created it, declared that it was all very good. So that for God, both spirit and matter, mind and body, are alike good. When man fell in the totality of his being. You often hear the emphasis that we should, as Christians, be more spiritual. Well, now, the people who say that don't fully realize perhaps what they mean. In fact, we're all guilty of using that language because it's become so much a part of our language. I know at times I'm sure, used it. But we really don't mean that. What good is there in being spiritual, necessarily? After all, Satan is a spiritual being, and he is totally evil. You can be satanic and be spiritual. what we mean really is that we should be godly. To be godly in all our beings. Now, because of the influence of Manichaeanism, spirituality was held aloft as the great and the good objective of man. And the godly man was one who fled from the world of matter to the world of spirit, from the world of desire to the world of mind, from the world of darkness to the world of light, so that he was continually forsaking this world for this world. This meant also that if you were too interested in material things, there was something wrong with you. Now you find this among some people. They act as if you are interested in being well-dressed, and if you really enjoy food, there's something very, very ungodly about you. You're not spiritual. Well, this is not biblical. The Bible tells us that God blessed Abraham materially. The Bible makes it clear that we are to rejoice in the good things that God has given us. Nowhere does the Bible despise material things, nor does it identify sin as material. It identifies sin as rebellion against God, as trying to be your own God. And sin is as much in the mind as it is in the body. Sin is something that possesses, that governs the whole life of man. Just as holiness, godliness, possesses and governs the whole life of man. Now we've taken a little time to go into this matter of theology, because it is so important to an understanding of a very basic aspect of church history as it affects American history. Because St. Augustine, who was a very great theologian, very sound in many respects, strong in emphasizing predestination, strong in emphasizing the sovereignty of God, strong in his emphasis on the Trinity, had, as a young man, been a Manichaean for a while, he never entirely shook the influence. And so, when he looked ahead to the future of the world, his idea of the church was that the church was a kind of a monastic cell. That the purpose of Christians was to withdraw from the world, and of the church to reach out into an evil world and take people and bring them inside the walls, as it were, of the monastery. So all around you had the evil city of man. That's biblical, to see the world as divided between the city of man and the city of God, but not to see the development as St. Augustine saw. And so, he felt, what we must do is to bring people into the church. And the church is a kind of fortress and a refuge where you sit out and wait out the end of the world. So, in a sense, the essence of being saved was to retreat from the world. Now, to hold such a belief certainly is going to color your attitudes towards what constitutes the Christian life. And so it is that wherever Augustinian eschatology has had a profound influence, as in the Middle Ages, the highest form of Christian life is to retreat into the cloisters, into the convent, into the monastery, to withdraw from the world into the church. In the same way where it has had a profound influence, as in various amillennial circles, It has produced a like belief. You had Protestant groups, for example, here in this area, not too far away, that is, in Pennsylvania, who in the colonial period were building cloisters, monastic cells, and when you were converted, you withdrew from the world and you lived in a convent. And for many of these groups, they were against marriage, Protestant groups. Why? Because they had bought St. Augustine's eschatology. And they believed there should be a retreat from the world. St. Augustine's view, thus, was very powerful throughout the centuries. Now, it did not determine everything within the Catholic Church, because there were Catholics who did not share this. But it was determinative in a good deal of the Middle Ages. It has been very powerful in the Protestant Church. The Christian Reformed Church, for example, some of you may know of it, is predominantly amillennial or Augustinian in its outlook. To a very great extent, the Orthodox Presbyterian Church is. To a very great extent, a great many other churches and denominations are Augustinian. Others hold to other positions of some of the church fathers, and instead of retreat, they hold to rapture, that you're going to be raptured out of this evil world, which is a variation of this kind of a belief. Now, a belief that was becoming increasingly important before the Reformation, and men like Columbus held it, and which after the Reformation became very important in England and then especially in America, was the postmillennial position, which held to an eschatology of victory. That instead of running away from this world, instead you saw the whole of the world as the work of God. It's all God's world. And therefore, the Christian man has the obligation to conquer in every area. As a result, under this eschatology, the duty was to conquer the wilderness, to conquer in one area of scholarship after another, to conquer in one area of institutional life after another. It's not surprising, for example, that the Puritans in England were the founders of modern science. All that in America, under the influence of this type of eschatology, there was a very, very tremendous outburst of inventiveness. This was a form of conquest. Go out and conquer in one area after another as a religious duty. So, there was emphatically a very, very different character to any country that held, instead of retreat and rapture, to the belief in conquest. This emphatically, when it is seen as a duty under God to conquer, is going to change a person's outlook. When America was settled, the early settlers predominantly had this eschatology of conquest. They came over here and they sent back statements to England declaring that they wanted people to come and join them. In what? In a program of turning a wilderness into a paradise. There has been a book written by a former teacher of mine who is at Harvard, precisely on this theme, how the Puritans saw the entire continent as a wilderness to be made into a paradise, and that this was their Christian duty, that unless they turned that wilderness into a paradise, they were falling short of their duty to God, and they had been guilty of sin. They failed. Now, this early attitude began to falter and disappear after about 1650, the first generation of settlers, when they left, their sons and those that followed them were not particularly given this point of view. We shall subsequently come back to this subject. But one of the most interesting things is that we misunderstand early American history if we think the Christians were in the majority. When the Mayflower came to this country, only a small handful of those on the Mayflower were actually Christian. The rest came over because they wanted to get away from the old country, or they thought they could make money. This was true throughout the colonial period. This was true in early constitutional America. The majority of the people were not Christian. Then why did they have so strong a social order? Why was it so devout and godly? Precisely because the Christians, whenever they were dedicated to a belief in their obligation to conquer in Christ's name and to rule in the name of Christ, were doing precisely that. And it is amazing the extent to which they did dominate the society. It would be very difficult for us to grasp the extent to which they dominated the society of the time. Perhaps when we return to this subject later, I can bring you some of the statistics on the Mayflower. I don't have them with me at the present. But emphatically, the proportion was very, very small. It remained small for a long time. There are today more people who are Bible-believing Christians than in any previous era of American history, probably. And they are more Anglican. Why? Because they do not have an eschatology of victory. And they had it at that time. This made the difference. We shall be dealing somewhat later with the extent of the ignorance of Americans of the Bible, especially when the frontier was opened up. I'm going to give an entire hour. We might get to it tomorrow, if not early in the week, with the frontier and the religion of the frontier, how ignorant the people in the frontier were. These people went out there, they lived out there, far from anyone else. There would sometimes be a mile between log cabins. And the children would grow up without any knowledge of Bible. I'll tell you a good many stories later on of how ignorant they were, but just one now is a little foretaste of the kind of thing that we're going to be dealing with. One of the frontier preachers who went to a lonely log cabin to work with these people, to speak to them about Scripture, and to try to convert them. And several of the families for a few miles round about were invited there for the evening. When they sat down to eat, opened both the dinner and later on the service with prayer. And the next day, when he was going elsewhere, a little boy who had heard about him from other boys came up to him and said, "Are you the man who talks to his plate?" Now that's all he knew about prayer. It was something totally new to him. And somebody who began dinner with prayer was some peculiar character who talked to his plate. Now that's how ignorant people were of any knowledge of God. And yet, that society was dominated by Christianity precisely because of its eschatology. You see, you never have to have a majority to dominate a country. Only a dedicated minority who knows what it believes and is determined in the name of God or of whatever it believes to establish a particular belief or faith as the dominant social force of the day. Now, before we go any further, are there any questions about anything we've dealt with this time? In a sense, our subject thus far has been more theoretical and theological than historical. But I do want you to understand this thoroughly, so please do not hesitate to ask any questions. If you think the question in your mind might be stupid, don't worry. That's the best kind of question because it's the kind of question you can learn the most from. No questions. All understood it perfectly? All right, perhaps I'll ask a question or two. Now, in terms of a Manichaean faith, to what great extent has the modern world been influenced? And to what extent would you say the modern hippie is a Manichaean? Yes. Could you speak up a little louder? Right. Did you all hear that? The hippie, because he rejects the material world and he despises people who are interested in material things. He rejects cleanliness. And people who are Manichaean tend to feel there's a virtue in being dirty because it shows you're despising the body, you see. You're not putting any great value on it. The Manichaean tends, therefore, like the hippie, to despise the body, to despise material things. They look down, the hippies do, on you and on their parents because they feel there's some virtue in having a good home and good clothes and being well-dressed and clean and neat in appearance. Consider, for example, one very important sign of Manichaeanism in our midst. The fact that for the first time in a long, long time, lice have become common. There was an article in the Wall Street Journal this year about how lousy public school students have become. And it has become a major problem in many, many public schools. The kids are lousy. And the biggest growth industry of the past few years has been the industry dealing with lice powder or some kind of lice control. They've been doubling their business every year or so. And, of course, this is a product of Manichaeanism, a contempt of this world, a contempt of anything that points to a respect for the body. Now, any other examples of Manichaeanism in our modern world? Can anyone else think of instances, Manichaeanism? Well, how about the radicals and their contempt of middle-class virtues, middle-class liking for good homes? Have you noticed how, although the hippies talk a great deal about ecology, if they take over any house, the yard becomes an ecological disaster? Now that's Manichaeanism. They may talk a great deal about having the respect for nature, but ultimately they really desire to despise it. Because being Manichaean, they're just using it as an argument against us, that we who profess to like the world are really abusing it. So they have a Manichaean contempt for the world round about them. Now, let me add this. Some Manichaeans would switch their gods. They would say, this god is the good god, and this is the bad god. So we're going to like matter, darkness, and desire. And this is why today you have a group of people who worship what? Satan, yes. Because you've had a revival of Manichaeanism through the hippies, Satan worship follows. And those who are Satan worshipers have become so precisely because they have decided this is good and this is bad. They've divided the world in two. And they say, we've got to see the world in part as good, in part as evil. And yet God said it was all good, it all fell, it is all going to be redeemed. And it is not one aspect of the world that is good or bad, it is sin. Sin that is the problem. Sin that corrupts both mind and body. Now, any other examples of Manichaeanism in our midst? Well, anyone who is pessimistic or hopeless about the future has elements of Manichaeanism in it. Because he is saying the world is just going to go to the dogs because it isn't the world that is important in the sight of God. It's just souls. And yet God so loved the world, the whole of it, that he gave his only begotten Son, that whosoever believeth on him should not perish, but have everlasting life. And how did he create man? In his image, to exercise dominion and subdue the earth. When man fell from that task, what did God do? Through Christ, he redeemed him and restored him, so that man now has the obligation to exercise dominion and to subdue the earth. And when man departs from a biblical faith, he loses hope about the world. And he starts withdrawing into a convent or monastery, and he treats the church as though, well, here's the safe place. Let the world around me go to pieces. The important thing is I'm in the church. He retreats. He develops the psychology of retreat. And wherever you have the psychology of retreat, of surrender, you have Manichaeanism. There's a great deal of Manichaeanism around us, isn't there? Because if we hold to a biblical position, we're going to believe in victory. If God be for us, who can be against? Our time is just about up, and I don't want to start the second half prematurely. When is it that you go to your class? Is it 10 of, or exactly? Yes. Are there any questions now? the question is, was Manichaeism a majority belief in Augustine's time? We don't know enough. You know, they didn't have a census going around asking everyone, are you a Manichaean or are you a Christian, for one thing. Earlier, it was illegal to be a Christian. It had become legal by Augustine's time. But Manichaeanism had earlier, somewhat earlier than Augustine, been perhaps the dominant religion in the empire. It had taken over very powerfully until Constantine, almost a century before, had made Christianity the official religion. Now, this didn't mean Christianity was the majority, but it meant it was now in control of the state to a great extent. But Manichaeanism had been very, very powerful. The origin of Manichaeanism was probably in Persia. It had been spread westward by the troops because soldiers picked up this religion and everywhere they went, they propagated it. And so it became extremely powerful. Now, Manichaeanism again came into the church and became a powerful threat in the Middle Ages. It had a variety of names that are perhaps unfamiliar to you. Paulician, Bogomil, Cathars, and Albigensian. Now, have any of you ever heard of any of these names? Yes. Now, the Albigensians for a while conquered and controlled almost all of southern France. And during the Middle Ages, the Vatican proclaimed a crusade against the Albigensians, and they went in, and after a very bitter and hard-fought war, they wiped out a great portion of Albigensian power there. But there are some who believe that to this day, there are still underground elements of Manichaeanism or Albigensianism in southern France. Well, our time is up now, so you may go to your class.